Mind the Gap, you're in the Hot Springs Underground, a weekly podcast about local music, art, film, and more. Brought to you from the Razorback Camper Sales Studio. I'm your host, Lance Brownfield. For those of you at home, I'm joined today by Chuck Dodson. He's a local musician. So tell me a little bit about your background in music, your career and all that.
I was born here, and my mother was a local musician back in the days of gambling and gangsters and casinos. And I've got pictures of my mother where, like, she would play in these local casino ballrooms with, like, bands where she was the only female. Huh. And there were all these guys sitting in black tuxedos holding horns and guitars. And my mother is at the end in a beautiful white gown like a Disney princess by a grand piano. So, like, that was my mom. And she also played every Sunday morning at church. And so when I was 3 or 4 years old, this lady became my music teacher. She was able to play classical music, but she could also play jazz and country. She played country on local radio shows, live country music. She sang in trios. So I had music kind of from both worlds of, you know, the European classical tradition where you learn this finger technique and you try to play Chopin and Rachmaninoff and Bach and Mozart. But I was also hearing jazz, country music, and gospel, Southern gospel music. And so I grew up with that. I had piano lessons every day, starting when I was 4 years old, because my mother taught me at home, right? And so she's in there cooking, and she makes me sit at the piano and play that song 25 times. And if she's not finished chopping carrots, play it another 25 times. And so it was like probably by the time I was 10 or 11, I'd fulfilled the 10,000 hour rule, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I became a professional musician when I was about 14. And I, you know, going to Hot Springs High School, and I start playing recording sessions and concerts with older musicians who are professionals, you know, and so I was very fortunate. And I guess I started becoming known. And when it was time for me to have a career, when I was getting out of high school, I wanted to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston. And my Hot Springs High School guidance counselor looked at my grades. She didn't understand that Berklee was a music school. And she looked at my grades, and she's like, no, there's no way you can go there. Your grades aren't good enough. She just saw that it was a prestigious university in Boston, you know,
yeah. That
looked really important and all, which it was. And she shot that down, and I was so discouraged, I didn't try to go. And I ended up staying here and working construction with my dad for a couple of years before I moved to Nashville to play in a band. And the thing you have to know about me was that the other thing in my life when I was a kid was religion. I was very religious. I grew up in a Christian church, and I was all about, what does God want me to do with my life? You know, mm-hmm. Music was kind of my identity. But even above and below that, I was this Christian person who was really wanting to do what God wanted me to do. And so when I was getting out of high school, I was like, do I want to be a minister or do I want to be a musician?
Yeah.
And I was able to combine those things, and I went into Christian rock.
Oh.
And so, you know, when I'm in my early 20s, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm playing with probably the top Christian rock band in the world, who's a band nobody's heard of now. But at that time, the lead singer was the male vocalist of the year, the record of the year, the song of the year, band of the year, all those awards. So we were super hot. And the three biggest Christian record labels all broke the record for the top amount of money ever offered to a solo artist, you know, for this guy I was playing for. And I didn't last a long time there for a few reasons. I think part of it was that it was not what I hoped it would be. Part of it was that I wanted to be more creative and artistic, and these people were kind of more like they were older, and they were used to like working with record labels and kind of doing what you're supposed to do. And I was a little radical in that context. Part of it was because I made some mistakes and I probably pissed some people off, you know. At any rate, I ended up back here in Hot Springs. I left my career, I left Nashville, and I decided I wanted to be a producer instead of just a piano player. I was playing piano, by the way, playing keyboard up until that time. It just so happened that this was the moment that digital music was starting.
Oh.
And the first generation of, like, home recorders were being marketed, and drum machines, and, you know, keyboards that could imitate instruments, you know, not just the old school synthesizers that, you know, were huge and had wires, you know, coming out of holes. And so I was able to start a production company in my parents' bedroom, like my bedroom at my parents' house here in Hot Springs. And I started getting work from ad agencies. I was producing music for gymnasts and beauty pageant contestants and like songwriters. And I was just one of the first people doing this. And it became successful. And within 10 years, I had a nationally known production company based here in Hot Springs. I had music on ESPN. I had music in TV shows and movies. And I was doing like, at one time I had a bio that listed all the stuff I did. It was like from presidential campaigns to like doing music for Russian church services and London, England dance halls. And just, it was crazy. I had music all over the world that I was making here at my house in Hot Springs. And I became known in competition music, any kind of production that had a time limit, like United States Gymnastics Association, four exercises had to be a minute and a half. Mm-hmm. Well, I made those. And I had to have the ballet section and the tumbling section and the section where they run like mad across the mat from one corner to the other and do their leap. And, you know, I wrote those songs and produced them. I got to be really well known in the Miss America pageant organization. Was one of the top arrangers in the nation in Miss America. And for a while, I had the highest winning percentage of any Miss America coach in the United States. So it was kind of like a weird career. The same time, I'm working with like grunge bands and punk bands, producing them. I'm working with songwriters that do everything from worship music to like country music to folk music to like pop music. I produced opera music, Broadway music, you know, bluegrass music, heavy metal music. You know, I was also a guitar player, by the way. So it turned out to be this really strange career that I could not have planned.
No.
And there were years, I'm pretty sure I was the only person in Arkansas who was making a living exactly the way I was making a living, which if you think about it, is pretty remarkable, you know. But that was sort of my first half of my life up until midlife. Everything kind of radically changed at midlife, you know.
Tell me about that.
I had sort of a crisis where I think a lot of it was that music was kind of forced on me when I was young, you know, not to diss my mother, but she really sort of forced me to learn piano. Didn't give me a lot of choice.
Yeah.
I wanted to play baseball for a lot of my childhood and she wouldn't let me. It's like, no, you're going to play piano.
It's a big difference.
I kind of did therapy and I became a poet. I started writing a lot, like not writing music, but writing words, poems and essays, screenplays, and short stories. And I got involved in the poetry scene here. This was in the 90s when Hot Springs had this amazing poetry community where the most famous poets in the world were coming here. And our poetry slam had the highest grand prize of any poetry event, certainly in the United States, and some people said in the world. It was, we gave away more money than the national championship.
Wow.
Which was amazing. Yeah. Like Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Deal.
And that was all thanks to, you know, a local doctor named Paul Tucker who loved poetry, and he just put up a lot of money to make poetry a thing here. So I got involved in that, and I ended up going to the National Poetry Slam. That was 1999 in Chicago. At the Poetry Championship, the CBS show 60 Minutes was there. They had decided to do a segment about what is slam poetry and how does it work, what does it look like. And they filmed me on stage during a semifinal round. And I did this crazy, very loud poem where I'm all over the stage. Part of the time I'm a Pentecostal preacher. Part of the time I'm imitating Satan. And the crowd kind of went crazy. A lot of the crowd actually dressed up like the devil for this. And like Team San Francisco was there and they all were dressed like the devil and they were screaming for me. And CBS filmed this. And so I was put on 60 Minutes as a performance poet. I got more screen time than the Poet Laureate of the United States, who was Robert Pinsky,
wow,
the famous poetic author, who was speaking against slam. He didn't like slam. But they put me on more than they put him on. And so I was kind of well known all of a sudden. I actually got a call from LA about doing an HBO poetry special. That was when, you know, I think it was called Deaf Poetry Jam, was a big deal.
Yeah.
And at that point, I decided I don't want to do poetry anymore. And I stopped doing poetry. And I sort of moved into downtown Hot Springs. In the year 2000, I got a loft in downtown Hot Springs. I'd lived downtown before, but not for very long. And I ended up having an art space down there that became a pretty big deal. Arkansas Times named it Gallery of the Year 1 year. They said of all the galleries in Hot Springs, or actually in Arkansas, it was a place where you were most likely to see a celebrity, which was kind of cool. And I did it because we had all these young artists in Hot Springs who didn't have a place to show their work because our art scene had become kind of traditional and conservative. The galleries were, you know, no offense to anybody, but they were kind of just trying to survive by selling work to rich people building lake houses.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really cutting edge art anymore. But these kids had grown up back in the Benigni days when Hot Springs had a real cutting edge, you know, art scene. And they were doing this amazing work that was influenced by kind of a combo of punk, skateboard, and graffiti culture. You know, they were inspired by people like Shepard Fairey and Damien Hirst and Basquiat. None of the galleries would show their work. They were afraid of it. Plus, all the kids were skateboarding around downtown and, you know, making graffiti and being chased by the police. And the gallery owners didn't want to, like, get involved with them. So I started a gallery and started showing all that work. And we ended up in Juxtapose magazine and Paste magazine and the New York Daily News. New York Daily News. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution did a story on us. The New York Daily News came to Hot Springs and did a big story about Hot Springs art. And my gallery was the only gallery they mentioned by name.
Hmm.
And we were the smallest gallery and probably the least. We probably made less money. Well, I know we made less. We didn't make any money. We made less money than any of the other galleries, but we were the only one that got a mention.
Wow.
So it was kind of a very cool time for me to do that, which was so different from anything I'd done before. At the same time, I became a documentary filmmaker. I started producing movies. That was about 2003. And I've made several movies. Some of them have won awards. Some of them have been shown at major universities. I've gotten to go lecture at some of those places. Incidentally, one place that showed my movie was Berklee College of Music in Boston, the school I wanted to go to when I was a senior at Hot Springs High, that my guidance counselor told me to give up on. There's no way you can go there because your grades aren't good enough. One of their senior professors, who was the head of their neurology department, called me and said, may we please show your movie and will you come and speak?
So it came full
circle. That was kind of a confirmation, kind of a win for me. I love that.
Yeah, definitely.
But so anyway, that brings us up to where I'm, you know, past middle age. And I'm this guy who has done several things now. And eventually, it's like, okay, how do I fit music back into my life? And I've been able to do that in a really interesting way. I forgot to mention that I started a fashion archive that almost 10 years ago, I started buying clothes. And it's become a big deal. It's like I now have, as far as I'm aware, one of the biggest privately owned fashion archives in this part of the United States. Most of the others are owned by universities or fashion schools. And I've got thousands of pieces. I've got over 250 designers in my collection, which is remarkable. I decided to pull Marc Jacobs' pieces a few months ago. And just in a few hours, I had pulled 50 pieces of Marc Jacobs. So think about that for a second. It's like if I've got over 250 labels and I've got, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 pieces by one label, you can imagine how much I have.
Yeah.
And so hopefully in the next year or so, I'm going to be able to find ways to take that public because I want to share it not only with our community, but the world. You know, it's kind of a cool archive. I don't want to get into that because I know you're about music, but fashion archives are interesting because most of them have focus. Like, you know, Kim Jones, who's the head of Dior, his archive focuses on London fashion of the punk era.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Hamish Bowles, who's the, you know, one of the editors of Vogue magazine, he focuses on those amazing Oscar de la Renta and Balenciaga gowns from the old days that are worth $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a piece. And, you know, like David Cassavance in New York City focuses on the Belgian school, on like, you know, Raf Simons and like Helmut Lang and that kind of thing. And he rents them out to people like Kanye and Lady Gaga who are, or Kendrick Lamar, who are making music videos or doing red carpets. Mine doesn't have a focus. My only focus is it's what I like. Chuck likes this, and therefore it's in the archive. The whole world is represented. I have stuff from Japan, Australia, all over Europe, you know, small American labels nobody's heard of. Yeah. I have stuff from all eras, except I don't go back too far. Most of my stuff is from the 80s to the present day. A lot of it's brand new stuff. Hmm. You know, probably, I don't know what percentage, but a good percentage of my archive is brand new stuff with the tags on it, you know, that I've been able to collect. So it's kind of become a big deal for me, the fashion archive.
Hey guys, this is Kimberly.
And I'm Mason.
We're with Hillstead.
We're a local rock band based right here in Hot Springs, Arkansas. We write, record, and play music here in the Spa City and around the state.
We'd love for you to check out our music streaming on all platforms now. Find us on Facebook and Insta and look for our upcoming shows and merch at hillsteadtheband.com.
Thanks for listening.
Just to wrap up this story, I've been able to get back to my roots as a piano player, an actual acoustic piano player. Even though I've got a studio with, you know, all the latest plugins and toys, that, you know, digital mics, and I love electronic music. But something that's really kind of nice now is that in my old age, I'm a much better piano player than I've ever been before. Which is rare. You know, music's like math or sports. You tend to like peak when you're young, and when you're older, you rest on your laurels and hope that people remember what you've done years ago. I'm better now than I've ever been playing the piano. And I'm doing this thing where when I go to the piano, I try to play something I have never played before or not even thought of before, and that I've never heard anyone else do before.
That's tough.
And that's very hard.
Yeah. It's tough.
It's really hard, and you don't always succeed, but that's the goal. And it's kind of funny that you can't practice that. You know, you can practice other things that inform that or maybe make that better. You can practice your technique, but I'm kind of afraid to play the piano now when I'm by myself if I'm not recording, because I feel like I'm wasting a song.
Yeah.
Because if I'm playing things that I've never played before, that means I can only play them one time. You know, think about that. That's kind of interesting. It's like that William Basinski project. It's like you play it one time and it's destroyed and it's gone and you never hear it again unless you record it. And so I'm sort of, my piano playing has become more precious because of that. I'll go to the piano, and if I'm really going to try to play something for real, I'll always record it because it's going to be a one-time only thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of made music really a big deal for me again. It's kind of sacred again.
Yeah.
And I like to think I'm doing some things very few other people are doing. I listen to a lot of music. I listen to music hours a day. I'm always digging up unknown artists to listen to. And I haven't really heard anybody doing what I'm doing, you know, that sounds like what I'm doing. A few people are close. But yeah. I'm kind of proud of that right now.
And now you've got your whole life to look back on, you know, to inspire your music versus, you know, a younger person, they've only got a few years of experience to build their music on, whereas you've got, you know, all these things you've done, all these experiences you've had to kind of write about or kind of feel in your music.
Yeah, I think that's true. I like to think that when I play now, in my brain is Thelonious Monk and Elton John. Mm-hmm. And Keith Emerson and John Lord and you know, like Leon Russell. And there's Art Tatum in there and Oscar Peterson in there. And there's, like, Hargis Pig Robbins in there. And there's, like, you know, all these people in my brain. Cecil Taylor's in there. And Matthew Shipp's in there. The key is don't do anything you've ever heard any of them do, though.
Yeah.
Don't copy them. Just, like, let them be in there, like, almost like a ball of piano energy. You know, but it's got to be original. I've got to play something I've never thought of before. And by the way I do that is usually it happens when I'm just at, I live alone. Okay. I'm a single guy. I live alone. My cat died 2 years ago, so I'm totally alone now. And so it's always quiet there, and I will be like watching TV, or I'll be having dinner, or I'll be cleaning the kitchen or something like that. And I'll just feel this urge to go to the piano. That's when I perform. I don't plan it.
Yeah.
Because I think if you plan it, things start coming into your head.
Yeah.
You start having ideas. So I run to the piano quickly before I have time to formulate any kind of plan about music. And I turn my phone on and I video it. And I just start playing. I do not think about keys or speed or what notes I'm going to play. I just start playing. And so it's like the fact that I grew up with classical technique helps. The fact I've studied and played all this different kind of music, these different styles help.
Yeah.
The fact that my dad loved Johnny Cash and Chet Atkins and Merle Travis and Elvis Presley, you know. The fact my mother played jazz and played for gospel quartets. The fact that I grew up playing Rachmaninoff and Mozart. All of that stuff is in there. And it's crazy, the stuff I play.
Well, it sounds like you've done it all over the years, kind of. You've done art, you've done film, you've done music. You've kind of touched all the creative fields. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's been... Yeah, I would not trade lives with anybody. I feel super fortunate.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't made a lot of money. You know, I'm not famous. But I love my life. I'm proud of what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best part is that I feel like I'm getting better at it.
Well, that's awesome. Well, is there anything you'd like to say before we wrap things up?
There's a question a lot of people ask me. I get it a lot, like when I go out. You know, and see people ask me if I won a Grammy Award, because there is a rumor out there, especially in Hot Springs, about Chuck and a Grammy Award. And to set the record straight on that, in about 2007 and 8, I worked on a documentary film about the blues legend Pinetop Perkins, who I think still is the oldest person to win a Grammy Award. He won a Grammy when he was 97 or 98. It's crazy. But he was a Muddy Waters piano player. He's just one of the great Delta blues musicians. He was considered the last great Delta blues piano player to be alive, you know, of the classic era. Mm-hmm. And this guy produced a documentary about him, and he asked me to be the narrator. Mm. And I ended up doing all of the post-production on the audio. There were a lot of famous musicians in the movie. And so this film producer brought me a recording on an old disc, CD. And he said, hey, listen to this. This is a Pinetop concert that we recorded in Chicago. I don't think it's any good, but just listen and see if you think you could save any of it. Or if not, I'm just going to throw it away because it's really not very good. And so I listened to it, and it was awful. Whoever was recording it wasn't trying. It was obvious, like, that they had a recorder at the soundboard, and this guy was, like, forgetting even to turn it on and off. Like, some of the songs, he wouldn't start recording until the song had already started.
Oh.
And so sometimes he would turn the recorder off before the song was finished. It was terrible. And I started not to even work on it and just tell the guy, yeah, throw it away because it's bad. But I did one song, and I sampled music from other songs that were in the same key. Fortunately, a lot of the songs were in the same key. And I was able to build, like, missing parts of the songs out of samples. And, like, I took crowd noise from different places and put it in. To, you know, it was just kind of a crazy thing. But I did this one song. And so when the producer heard it, he's like, oh, that's actually a lot better than I thought. He said, can I pay you to do the whole show, do the whole album? There were, like, 9 tracks. And I said, okay, because I needed money. I was kind of broke, and I just really needed the money. And so I was able to put this whole show together and make a CD out of it. And he picked it up and he paid me. And that was like the last I ever heard of it until about a year later. And I didn't realize he had released this thing. Pinetop's label had released it. They released the DVD of the documentary and they bundled it with this live album. And I had been speaking to a music class at National Park College, and I came out and I turned my phone on, and there was a message from this guy, and he said, "Hey, you're never going to believe it. Just remember that Pine Top album, that live album that you did? It was just nominated for a Grammy this morning in L.A." And I'm like, that's a joke. He can't be serious. It turned out it was actually nominated. It was nominated. It was one of five albums nominated for Best Traditional Blues Album of the Year.
Oh.
And everybody nominated was like well known, and it was like, I cannot believe. And the only reason it was nominated was because Pine Top was a living legend and his record label was involved. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't win. Pine Top had two albums that were nominated, and the other one was an all-star album with like Willie Big Eye Smith and Hubert Sumlin, the, you know, blues legend, and Pine Top played piano, and like, I think Bob Stroger was on bass. It was just like an all-star blues album. That won the Grammy.
Yeah.
Had that not been nominated, it's very possible that the album I did would have been nominated. So in subsequent interviews, like that I have copies of in newspapers, one was in this newspaper, the guy that was the producer said that I was the reason it was nominated for a Grammy. He said, Chuck Dodson made it Grammy material. That was his quote. So the truth about the Grammy nomination is that Chuck Dodson was not nominated for a Grammy. Like, it's not like, and the Grammy goes to Chuck Dodson. It was a Pine Top Perkins solo album. But I had been the editor and the mastering guy and sort of kind of like Frankensteined it together out of pieces that were pretty bad. So, you know, the producer admitted that I kind of made it good enough to be considered for a Grammy. So it's kind of ironic in a way that after my crazy music career, I would finally get a Grammy nomination as an engineer and editor.
Yeah, it's funny.
Which is something I'd never really focused on, you know. But there's that. If anybody cares, if anybody's listening, that's the Grammy story.
Yeah, it's funny how life takes us in a direction we never expected.
Boy, that's for sure. Yeah.
I want to thank you, Chuck Dodson, for coming on the show. And you guys out there, you can check him out. Do you have a website?
You know, no. They can check me out on Instagram. Chuck Dodson on Instagram. Chuck Dodson on Facebook. I post a lot of music on my Instagram.
There you go. You can check him out on his Instagram and his Facebook. At Chuck Dodson?
Yeah, I think it's just Chuck Dodson. It might be Dodson Chuck, I don't know. But if they go to my Facebook, there are links to other sites. There's a link to my Instagram, for example. I've also got a fashion Instagram where I post pictures of the archive and that kind of thing.
Cool. But I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Lance. I really appreciate it.
End of the line. New episodes are released every week from the Razorback Camper Sales Studio. I'm your host, Lance Brownfield, and I'll see you next time in the Hot Springs Underground.
Hey, podcast listeners! We've got a special deal just for you, $4.99 for 2 months, and it includes all of our digital access. I'm talking about all of our online content, our daily news clips, our puzzle library, and so much more. This is valid for new subscriptions only, so if you've been waiting to try it out, now's the time. Visit the link, hotsr.com/podcast23 to get this great deal.